You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and really pleased to have with me again Peter Buchvar. And Peter has been with me once or twice, I can't remember exactly. He was very recently with us, and really good to have him with us. Many of you have probably seen him over the years on CNBC and chatting with Rick Santelli and others. And so he's been around for a few years. He's certainly not anywhere nearly as old as I am, but he is a very seasoned Wall Street professional. And now is the chief investment officer of Blakely Advisory Group. And I believe that's a company with, I think this number is right, $7.5 billion in management, something like that. Anyway, Peter's very, very seasoned, and we're very privileged to have him with us. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Thanks, Jay. Appreciate having me on your show.
It's really good to have you. Let me make sure this. I saw a $7.5 billion number on your website. The bio has 3.5, which is right. I think it's 7.5, probably. It's probably an outdated bio.
The bio hasn't been updated.
Yeah, okay. All right, just wanted to be sure. Peter, before we get into the markets and what's going on today and in general what's going on longer term, I'd like maybe just talk a little bit about Blakely Capital. How is it distinct from others' financial planning and wealth management entities?
It's an independent firm. What makes it distinct? I guess it's distinct in its relationships and its broad level of services that we provide to clients. You know, it's not just asset management, but estate planning and broader financial planning and philanthropy and tax and insurance and so on. And it's been around for 30 plus years, so there's a track record here of service, and you know, we're continuing to expand not just within our hometown of New Jersey, but in different cities as well.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that you might not have some of the conflicts of interest that some other firms have, but it's, you're not selling financial products per se. You're individually helping investors. Is that right?
Right. Exactly. Sure. We're not tied to any of the big wirehouses, so we're not being shown product that we need or encouraged to sell to clients. It's creating the best portfolios, depending on what each individual client's financial needs are.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that you, at least an emphasis on your website was that you're sort of tailored to individual needs. So if that's the case, then I'm guessing that you're probably looking at clients that are, you know, in that top 10% of the income scale, probably. It's probably for larger scale clients for the most part, wealthier clients.
Well, it varies. I mean, we have older advisors, we have younger advisors, we have young clients, we have older clients. So it very much ranges. It could be a small account, a young person that's just in their beginning of their prime earning years. And, or it can be someone well established who's retired or sold a business and or is a high income earner. So we can fit any client in with a particular advisor regardless of their account size.
Okay, so if people are interested, they should go to your website, and I know that there's a way to connect there. So I just wanted to let people know something about Blakely Capital, because it is a substantial firm, and I think it's worth people knowing something about it. Well, today the equity markets are getting hit pretty hard. What's your take? What's going on? I see there's instability, it seems, in the Chinese markets, and a lot of the Chinese stocks or companies that are invested in China seem to be having some trouble today, I believe. But what is your take on today's market action?
It's definitely a factor, China, but also I find it interesting. You know, we've had this tremendous rally, of course, particularly over the past couple of months, particularly led by tech. And we have some big earnings coming up with Microsoft, Apple, and Google on tonight on Tuesday, and then followed by Facebook mm-hmm. Wednesday and Apple on Thursday. And what we've seen so far from other big tech like Tesla and Netflix, mm-hmm. those stocks sold off after their earnings. And you wonder, after the big run-up we've seen in the other big cap tech, whether they suffer the same thing. Breadth of the market has been weakening for months now. I mean, here we are late July, and Russell 2000 topped out in May. In March, and mid caps topped out in May, and so there's been a bifurcation in the market. Mm-hmm. Now, what that means, we'll have to see. I think a lot will depend on where the inflation story goes and how the Fed responds to that. And of course, we'll get a Fed meeting this week to help us figure that one out.
Yeah, or confuse us, whichever. I don't know.
More likely the latter.
Well, we look to people like you to help us ferret that out. Last time we talked, I believe we talked about rising inflation numbers, and since then, I think we've seen some new higher numbers. I believe it was before the 5.2 CPI and the 7.3 PPI. What's your sense? Is this? I mean, I think you've been of the school, at least when we last talked to you, that it's probably not transitory. I'm guessing these latest numbers have you thinking the same thing.
I do. I don't think it's temporary. I think people are too confident that supply chains will just quickly readjust and we'll be back to normal. I think that we've had years of underinvestment, particularly on the commodity side. We've had 10 years plus of underinvestment in housing. After the result of the aftermath of the bust, and unfortunately we've had this boom bust type economy going back to the late 90s, which you can even stretch that the shortage of semis is a consequence of the late 90s bubble, mm-hmm. because we learned that semis are a cyclical business, and after that bust, companies decided, hey, let me outsource semiconductor production. I'll just design it, and that'll be much more efficient. Well, we've seen from decades of now underinvestment because we've outsourced to others and didn't decide to build any factories ourselves, that now you throw in the auto sector as a new area of voracious demand, and now we don't have enough semis. And it's going to take years to bring that back on. I think that just-in-time inventory, which was a greaser of the wheels, so to speak, in terms of production efficiency and allowing companies to just perform at higher levels of inventory turns and low working capital needs, which led to higher productivity and lower prices, that just-in-time inventory after COVID is dead, and that companies are going to have to keep more inventory on the shelves, which means to higher capital needs, lower cash flows, lower productivity, and likely higher prices. Look at the wage story. Yes, in September, we're going to hopefully get more people back to work, but there's still a lot of incentives paying people not to work, particularly with the child tax credit, where families or people don't need to prove that they're going back to work. So I still think there's going to be sticky inflation, and I've said this on our last interview, that this whole debate on inflation being temporary or not is, there's no such thing as temporary inflation, first of all, because services inflation is always higher.
Yeah.
The good side, because of technology, production efficiency, and so forth, the 20 years leading into COVID, goods prices, ex energy and food, was basically zero. So that's where the so-called price stability has been. But when you combine the two, inflation's still higher again because of services. Well, now, so therefore the debate about temporary not is really only on the good side. Because again, services inflation is always higher. And now, if anything, because of higher rents, I believe it's only going to accelerate. And on the good side, at some point, things will normalize. I mean, after all, you can call the 1970s inflation transitory, right? Because of the rate of change slowed. But I don't think that the U.S. economy can handle even a couple of years of elevated inflation. Because we are a consumer-dependent economy, because we are already seeing stagflationary-type situations in particular industries where higher prices are now slowing demand. And you're seeing that in housing. If you look at weekly mortgage applications, yes, there's also supply issues and builders can't bring enough product to market. But when you're seeing 17% year-over-year home price increases measured by CoreLogic's number this week, that turns off buyers. When you have record high prices for autos or used cars, that turns off buyers. If an auto plant has to shut down because they can't get enough product, you know, that slows growth. So, ironically, the Fed believes that they're implementing what Jay Powell likes to say, powerful stimulus, but that stimulus is now leading to overkill, and running things hot is now resulting in a cooling down. And so it'd be interesting with that what the Fed will do. I think that they'll probably do nothing because they're worried about COVID, and won't address this inflation story that I think has legs to it. But keep in mind, we'll slow down from the annualized pace of core CPI of 8% over the past 4 months to something lower, just on a rate of change basis. But you know, a couple of years of even 3-4% inflation, that's a problem for just the consumer. It's a problem for interest rates. It's a problem for multiples. It's in 3-4% is more than double what people are used to.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of interest rates, Peter, how high do interest rates have to go before it takes the equity market down?
Well, if we look at the fourth quarter 2018, it was a Fed funds rate of 2.5% that led to a panic that resulted in Jay Powell totally backing off, 2.5%.
Right.
This year, we saw 1.75 10-year, and it resulted in a 10% pullback in the NASDAQ. NASDAQ, of course, got its legs back when yields started to fall, but... And at least that was at least one sign that valuations became important when rates rose. But, of course, with the global level of demand and credit multiples where they are, PE multiples and stocks where they are, in addition to a variety of other valuation metrics, there should be very little tolerance for another jump higher in interest rates.
It's just hard to see, and yet they have to go higher or else the Fed has to print. That's the way I see it. I mean, who's going to want to buy... Who buys treasuries, first of all? I mean, it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but the new money that the treasuries has had to raise has come mostly from the Fed printing, and I see some from pension funds, perhaps, that are large. But other than that, there's not any – I mean, foreigners are not buying new treasuries, are they, to any great extent? I don't know. Help me if I'm wrong on that. I'm not sure. But who's buying them, and why would anybody buy them?
Yeah, foreigners on a net basis have been – sellers, and so they're out of the picture. Their ownership stake as a percent of the U.S. Treasury market's down to about 1/3%. It was almost half at the peak back in 2011, 2012, I believe. But banks have been big buyers of bonds. You look at the loan data, C&I loans, credit card loans, real estate loans outside of residential. You know, they've fallen dramatically. So what are banks doing? They're taking deposits and they're buying U.S. treasuries.
Okay.
So they're a big buyer of treasuries.
Okay. So that's where some of the financing is coming from, I guess. They're not making loans, that's for sure, which means that the Main Street and the real economy isn't getting much of a boost in that regard anyway. And why would they make loans if the interest rates are so low? Was there enough juice in the interest rates to allow banks to be compensated for the risk they're taking on when they're lending into the real economy?
Well, that's another problem of a Fed policy, is that they've crushed loan margins to such an extent that banks have to be even more careful about the loans that they're going to extend. So, if you're a big company with access to the capital markets, you don't really care. But if you're a small, medium-sized business that relies on bank loans, the banks are going to be that much more discriminating in who they give loans to. I've seen and I've been partners in different businesses where getting a loan for a second store after a successful run with the first one was harder than getting a loan for the first one when you've never done it before.
Wow.
And I think a lot of that goes back to margin, loan margins being squeezed because of what the Fed has done. let alone what other central banks have done, of course, in Japan and Europe. That also is the case there. And it gets to my point that monetary policy is actually restrictive. Mm-hmm. It's run things too hot now cooling down, and they inhibit the flow of credit to small and medium-sized businesses.
It's tragic. It really is. Never enough time here, but regarding shortages and supply issues, I think it was American Airlines today said they're sort of warning people there may be a shortage of jet fuel this summer. Do you have any idea why that would be? I mean, it's just can you connect the dots on that?
One of the reasons is there's not enough trucks to deliver the fuel to the places that they need to end up. That's a main factor. I mean, there's literally a shortage of trucks, as there's a shortage of cars also.
Shortage of drivers.
One of the reasons why. And shortage of drivers as well.
Yeah.
There's essentially a shortage of almost everything, which is obviously a real challenge for a lot of businesses.
Yeah. Is this, Peter, because we've been sort of running a casino economy, kind of like instead of money going into real plant and equipment, it's sort of like you said, we outsourced a lot of manufacturing, and so we're not really producing the things we have to have to stay alive in America. We're relying on other countries to do it, and then people are just sort of in the equity market casino, making, you know, just and besides, they know that equities aren't going to be allowed to go down, right?
I mean, that's the feeling. Even though, you know, you look at the last two bear markets, the Fed fought it tooth and nail, and it didn't stop stock prices from readjusting lower. I'm sure we know each time we've had declines, at least post-financial crisis, the Fed has backed off from either QE or raising interest rates to stem the bleeding. That's created certainly a level of comfort / complacency on the part of investors, but, you know, it's paid to feel that way. It's paid to think that the Fed is going to do that. But the thing that inhibits any potential future response is this whole inflation story. You know, the Fed has license to do as they choose when inflation is low. The Fed was able to get away with zero rates for 7 years and all the QE in addition to other central banks because inflation was low. But if inflation is now all of a sudden persistently higher, then that changes the equation and the response function potentially.
A fly in the ointment, as it were. Just with only about 3.5 minutes or so left here, I'd just like to mention something that Ray Dalio, I don't know if you're a Ray Dalio fan at all or not, but he's talking about betting on the continuation of asset price inflation. In other words, equities, financial markets, and probably commodities. I think gold and precious metals as well. But then he's suggesting a hedge in the form of a short against treasuries. I guess believing that perhaps interest rates could get out of control the Fed loses control of interest rates. Does that strategy make any sense to you?
Well, if I'm right on inflation and sort of a stagflationary type environment, while some companies that have pricing power will be able to offset that, it is a PE multiple killer. So any sustainability of earnings, I think people are going to pay less for that. So that's why if you look at history, the stock markets typically is not a great inflation hedge in an inflationary environment. Now, certain stocks are, you know, gold stocks certainly were in the 70s and sure oil and gas stocks as well. But because the PE multiple usually compresses during those times, I'm not sure if that's necessarily the best strategy in an sustainable inflationary environment.
Yeah.
You know, with respect to the long end of the yield curve, you know, on paper, you say, yeah, it's got to be a short because if the inflation's here, why would you want to own long bonds? But you know, because of the influence of the Fed, it becomes a more difficult trade to put on. That said, I do think that we will have another repeat of the first quarter when you saw long-term rates jump. And that is because I think right now the market thinks that the Fed is going to somehow be ahead of the curve and will get control of inflation if it flares up. But I think that's just wishful thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Inevitably, they're bound to lose control, I would think. Peter, with just about 30 seconds left or so, what about gold? You would think with negative real rates, you would think that gold should be doing well now, but it's not particularly. What do you think is going on there?
Yeah, it's been frustrating, particularly the last couple of days when you've seen real rates go down and the dollar sell-off as well. I think up to this point, while real rates were still pretty negative, you had that dollar bounce that was a headwind. I wish I had an explanation. It's rather frustrating to watch. I do think that we are still in a gold-silver bull market, and I do think people are going to wake up to the fact that real rates are deeply negative and inflation is here to stay. Maybe it's just some hesitancy ahead of the Fed meeting and whether they're going to taper or not, and maybe after that meeting we'll have some clarity that will provide more of a pathway for gold and silver. That's my only thought. Other than that, I can't really think of any good explanation.
Well, we'll have to leave it go at that. Peter, thank you so much for spending time with us. Your insights are always very much welcome and very valuable to us. So thank you for being with us once again. Well, folks, that is, you bet. Anytime we'll have you back whenever you're available. Well, folks, that is all the time we have this week. Alistair McLeod will be with me next week. Alistair's insisting that the Federal Reserve has painted itself into a corner and is comparing the Fed's position with that of the Mississippi bubble back in the early 1700s. Also, Dr. Quentin Henning will be with me to talk about Lion One, and Michael Oliver returns. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
NV Gold Corporation, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTCQB, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in Nevada with an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2021, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors, a globally recognized technical team, report coverage from industry gold experts, and a strong treasury. Visit NVGoldCorp.com to learn more on this exciting story.